This, like other feedback systems, may lead to vicious circles and confusions if improperly managed, but self-awareness makes human experience resonant. It imparts that simultaneous echo to all that we think and feel, as the box of a violin reverberates with the sound of the strings. It gives depth and volume to what would otherwise be shallow and flat. Self-knowledge leads to wonder, and wonder to curiosity and investigation, so that nothing interests people more than people, even if only one's own person. Every intelligent individual wants to know what makes him tick, and yet is at once fascinated and frustrated by the fact that oneself is the most difficult of all things to know. For the human organism is, apparently, the most complex of all organisms, and while one has the advantage of knowing one's own organism so intimately, from the inside, there is also the disadvantage of being so close to it that one can never quite get at it. Nothing so eludes conscious inspection as consciousness itself. This is why the root of consciousness has been called, paradoxically, the unconscious. The people we are tempted to call clods and boors are just those who seem to find nothing fascinating in being human. Their humanity is incomplete, for it has never astonished them. There is also something incomplete about those who find nothing fascinating in being. You may say that this is a philosopher's professional prejudice, that people are defective who lack a sense of the metaphysical. But anyone who thinks at all must be a philosopher, a good one or a bad one, because it is impossible to think without premises, without basic and, in this sense, metaphysical assumptions about what is sensible, what is the good life, what is beauty, and what is pleasure. To hold such assumptions, consciously or unconsciously, is to philosophize. The self-styled practical man of affairs who pooh-poohs philosophy as a lot of windy notions is himself a pragmatist or a positivist, and a bad one at that, since he has given no thought to his position. If the human organism is fascinating, the environment which accompanies it is equally so, and not merely as a collection of particular things and events. Chemistry, biology, geology, and astronomy are special fascinations with the details of our environment, but metaphysics is fascination with the whole thing. I find it almost impossible to imagine a sensitive human being bereft of metaphysical wonder, a person who does not have that marvelous urge to ask a question that cannot quite be formulated. If, as we have been arguing, the only real atom, as Desjardins put it, is the universe, and the only real thing is everything, then what is it? Yet the moment I have asked this question, I must question the question. What sort of answer could such a question have? Ordinarily, one answers the question, what is it, by putting the designated thing or event into a class, animal, vegetable or mineral, solid, liquid or gas, running, jumping or walking. But what class will fit everything? What can possibly be said about everything? To define is to limit, to set boundaries, to compare and to contrast, and for this reason the universe, the all, seems to defy definition. At this point, the mind runs into an apparently absolute limitation, and one may well argue that it is therefore a misuse of the mind to ask such a question. Just as no one in his senses would look for the morning news in a dictionary, no one should use speaking and thinking to find out what cannot be spoken or thought. Logically, then, the question, what is everything, has no meaning, even though it seems to be profound. As Wittgenstein suggested, people who ask such questions may have a disorder of the intellect, which can be cured by philosophical therapy. To do philosophy, as he put it, is to think about thinking in such a way that we can distinguish real thinking from nonsense. But this neat logic does not get rid of the urge to know which expresses itself, however ineptly, in the question. As I said at the beginning, it is just unbelievably odd that anything is happening at all. Yet how am I to express this feeling in the form of a sensible question which could have a satisfactory answer? The point is, perhaps, that I am not looking for a verbal answer. Just as when I ask for a kiss, I do not want a piece of paper with a kiss written on it. It is rather that metaphysical wonder looks for an experience, a vision, a revelation which will explain, without words, why there is the universe, and what it is, much as the act of loving explains why we are male and female. It could be said, then, that the best answer to what is everything is look and see. But the question almost always implies a search for something basic to everything, for an underlying unity which our ordinary thinking and feeling do not grasp. Thought and sensation are analytical and selective, and thus present the world as no more than a multiplicity of things and events. Man has, however, a metaphysical instinct, which apparent multiplicity does not satisfy. What guarantee is there that the five senses, taken together, do cover the whole of possible experience? They cover simply our actual experience, our human knowledge of facts or events. There are gaps between the fingers. There are gaps between the senses. In these gaps is the darkness which hides the connection between things. This darkness is the source of our vague fears and anxieties, but also the home of the gods. They alone see the connections, the total relevance of everything that happens, that which now comes to us in bits and pieces, the accidents which exist only in our heads, in our limited perceptions. Idris Parry, Kafka, Rilke, and Rumpelstiltskin. Man is therefore intuitively certain that the entire multitude of things and events is on or in something as reflections are on a mirror, sounds on a diaphragm, lights and colours in a diamond, or the words and music of a song in the singer. This is perhaps because man is himself a unified organism, and that if things and events are on anything at all, they are on his nervous system. Yet there is obviously more than one nervous system, and what are all nervous systems on? Each other? This mysterious something has been called God, the Absolute, nature, substance, energy, space, ether, mind, being, the void, the infinite, names and ideas which shift in popularity and respectability with the winds of intellectual fashion, of considering the universe intelligent or stupid, superhuman or subhuman, specific or vague. All of them might be dismissed as nonsense noises if the notion of an underlying ground of being were no more than a product of intellectual speculation. But these names are often used to designate the content of a vivid and almost sensorily concrete experience, the unitive experience of the mystic, which, with secondary variations, is found in almost all cultures at all times. This experience is the transformed sense of self which I was discussing in the previous chapter, though in naturalistic terms, purified of all hocus-pocus about mind, soul, spirit, and other intellectually gaseous words. Despite the universality of this experience, and the impressive regularity with which it is described in the same general way, tough-minded types regard it as a commonly recurring hallucination, with characteristic symptoms like paranoia, which adds nothing to our information about the physical universe. For which the listener is directed to such works as Buck's Cosmic Consciousness, James's Varieties of Religious Experience, and Johnson's Watcher on the Hills. Just as we cannot say anything about everything, so, they argue, one cannot feel or experience anything about everything, for all our senses are selective. We experience by contrast, just as we think by contrast. To experience something underlying all experiences would thus be like seeing sight itself, as something common to everything seen, in terms of what color, what shape, other than all mutually contrasting colors and shapes, could we see sight itself. Yet metaphysics, like philosophy as a whole, is not something which can simply be cured or abandoned, as if it were an intellectual disease. The most anti-metaphysical philosophers have, in fact, a tacit metaphysics of their own, which lurks behind the assertion that all experience and all knowledge must be of classes and of contrasts and comparisons between them. To put it in the simplest way, they will allow that I can know and speak sensibly about something white, since I know white by contrast with black, and by comparison with red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. They will allow meaningful statements about dogs and cats because they are organic, as distinct from inorganic, mammals, as distinct from marsupials, and, though frisky, have clearly defined boundaries, which demarked them from the whole world of non-dogs and non-cats. But the underlying assumption that all knowledge is in terms of contrasts is as metaphysical as an assumption can be. Put it another way, all knowledge is a recognition of the mutual relations between sense experiences and or things and events. This comes perilously close to being a meaningful statement about everything. All things are known by their differences from and likenesses to each other. Backed up into this position, the anti-metaphysician can be carried, albeit with screams of protest, to an even deeper metaphysical level. Grant that the statement "everything is energy" conveys no more information than "everything is everything." To describe energy, I must differentiate it from non-energy or from mass, and thus if everything is to include non-energy, mass, space, or whatever, it will not only be uninformative but also nonsense to say that everything is energy. If, then, we are going to insist that energy can be known and described only by contrast with non-energy, this is virtually the same as saying that energy, or motion, is manifested, or simply exists, only by contrast with something relatively inert. But in this event, energy depends on the inert for being energetic, and the inert depends on the energetic for being inert. This relativity, or interdependence of the two, is as close to a metaphysical unity underlying differences as anyone could wish. I have sometimes thought that all philosophical disputes could be reduced to an argument between the partisans of prickles and the partisans of goo. The prickly people are tough-minded, rigorous, and precise, and like to stress differences and divisions between things. They prefer particles to waves and discontinuity to continuity. The gooey people are tender-minded romanticists who love wide generalizations and grand syntheses. They stress the underlying unities and are inclined to pantheism and mysticism. Waves suit them much better than particles, as the ultimate constituents of matter, and discontinuities jar their teeth like a compressed air drill. Prickly philosophers consider the gooey ones rather disgusting, undisciplined, vague dreamers who slide over hard facts like an intellectual slime which threatens to engulf the whole universe in an undifferentiated aesthetic continuum. Courtesy of Professor F.S.C. Northrop. But gooey philosophers think of their prickly colleagues as animated skeletons that rattle and click without any flesh or vital juices, as dry and desiccated mechanisms bereft of all finer feelings. Either party would be hopelessly lost without the other, because there would be nothing to argue about. No one would know what his position was, and the whole course of philosophy would come to an end. As things now stand in the world of academic philosophy, the prickly people have had the upper hand in both England and the United States for some years. With their penchant for linguistic analysis, mathematical logic, and scientific empiricism, they have aligned philosophy with the mystique of science, have begun to transform the philosopher's library or mountain retreat into something nearer to a laboratory, and, as William Earle said, would come to work in white coats if they thought they could get away with it. The professional journals are now as satisfactorily unreadable as treatises on mathematical physics, and the points at issue as minute as any animalcule in the biologist's microscope. But their sweeping victory over the gooey people has almost abolished philosophy as a discipline, for we are close to the point where departments of philosophy will close their offices and shift the remaining members of their faculties to the departments of mathematics and linguistics. Historically, this is probably the extreme point of that swing of the intellectual pendulum which brought into fashion the fully automatic model of the universe, of the age of analysis and specialization, when we lost our vision of the universe in the overwhelming complexity of its details. Academic philosophy missed its golden opportunity in 1921. When Ludwig Wittgenstein first published his Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which ended with the following passage: "The right method of philosophy would be this, to say nothing except what can be said, that is, the propositions of natural science, that is, something that has nothing to do with philosophy, and then always, when someone else wished to say something metaphysical, to demonstrate to him that he had given no meaning to certain signs in his propositions. This method would be unsatisfying to the other. He would not have the feeling that we were teaching him philosophy, but it would be the only strictly correct method. My propositions are elucidatory in this way. He who understands me finally recognizes them as senseless when he has climbed out through them, on them, over them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up on it. He must surmount these propositions. Then he sees the world rightly. Whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. This was the critical moment for all academic philosophers to maintain total silence and to advance the discipline to the level of pure contemplation, along the lines of the meditation practices of the Zen Buddhists. But even Wittgenstein had to go on talking and writing, for how else can a philosopher show that he is working and not just goofing off? But by a process which C.G. Jung called enantiodromia, the attainment of any extreme position is the point where it begins to turn into its own opposite, a process that can be dreary and repetitious without the realization that opposite extremes are polar and that poles need each other. There are no prickles without goo, and no goo without prickles. To go anywhere in philosophy, other than back and forth, round and round, one must have a keen sense of correlative vision. This is a technical term for a thorough understanding of the game of black and white, whereby one sees that all explicit opposites are implicit allies, correlative in the sense that they go with each other and cannot exist apart. This, rather than any miasmic absorption of differences into a continuum of ultimate goo, is the metaphysical unity underlying the world. For this unity is not mere oneness, as opposed to multiplicity, since these two terms are themselves polar. The unity, or inseparability, of one and many is therefore referred to in Vedanta philosophy as non-duality, Advaita, to distinguish it from simple uniformity. True, the term has its own opposite, duality, for insofar as every term designates a class, an intellectual pigeonhole, every class has an outside polarizing its inside. For this reason, language can no more transcend duality than paintings or photographs upon a flat surface can go beyond two dimensions. Yet, by the convention of perspective, certain two-dimensional lines that slant towards a vanishing point are taken to represent the third dimension of depth. In a similar way, the dualistic term non-duality is taken to represent the dimension in which explicit differences have implicit unity. It is not at first easy to maintain correlative vision. The Upanishads describe it as the path of the razor's edge, a balancing act on the sharpest and thinnest of lines. For to ordinary vision, there is nothing visible between classes and opposites. Life is a series of urgent choices demanding firm commitment to this or to that. Matter is as much like something as something can be, and space is as much like nothing as nothing can be. Any common dimension between them seems inconceivable, unless it is our own consciousness or mind, and this doubtless belongs to the side of the matter, everlastingly threatened by nothingness. Yet, with a slight shift of viewpoint, nothing is more obvious than the interdependence of opposites. But who can believe it? Is it possible that myself, my existence, so contains being and nothing that death is merely the off interval in an on/off pulsation, which must be eternal, because every alternative to this pulsation, for example, its absence, would in due course imply its presence? Is it conceivable then that I am basically an eternal existence, momentarily and perhaps needlessly terrified by one half of itself because it has identified all of itself with the other half? If the choice must be either white or black, must I so commit myself to the white side that I cannot be a good sport and actually play the game of black and white, with the implicit knowledge that neither can win? Or is all this so much bandying with the formal relations between words and terms without any relation to my